The factory floor of Gorham Paper and Tissue is a miserable place on a hot summer day. The massive cylinders turning watery pulp into paper are hot, and the water that passes through them creates a thick veil of humidity. Deeper into the mill is the small, cool control shack that's Rolly LeClaire's domain. Underneath the safety glasses and steel-toed boots, he's a good-natured, funny guy. He's been on this mill floor since 1977, and he's proud of his deep family roots in this line of work.
My grandfather immigrated from New Brunswick, Canada, right after the Depression, worked at the Burgess Mill, which is up in Berlin. My father was a papermaker here for 44 years, and I chose to do the same.
LeClaire is like a lot of longtime North Country residents. Going back to the late 1800s, French-Canadian immigrants would venture to northern New Hampshire to work in its thriving lumber, pulp, and paper mills. Other factories helped build the area up as well. Even as manufacturing declined in the 1980s, the region held on. But then, a few years ago, the death watch began.
We had Wausau that closed, that employed over 200, Isaacson Steel, and there was approximately 175 employees there. We had the car freshener plant that just closed with approximately 50 employees there. We had the Ethan Allen plant on the Canadian border.
And now Gorham Paper and Tissue is the last paper mill in the North Country. It's changed hands multiple times and shut down twice, once in 2000 and again 10 years later. Both times, LeClaire was laid off.
First time, I was lucky because there was a lot of work. This time around was totally different.
During his first layoff, LeClaire found a construction job in the southern part of the state. But this time, with construction hurting in the down economy, that option was gone. And in the North Country, there were a handful of jobs at grocery stores and Walmart, mostly part-time and without benefits. Still, competition was fierce.
When you fill out resumes and you send them out and you put down that you're 50, well, back then I was 58, and I have a high school education and I'm a papermaker, I'll tell you what, you're kind of limited to finding jobs associated with your skills.
I have to try to maintain a wet line somewhere in where it is now. If it gets too dry, the sheet will break.
Watching LeClaire on the factory floor as he rushes around turning valves, pulling levers, and pushing buttons, it's clear that he's very good at papermaking. And it's a tough job, but it's work he's grateful for. Last year, the mill reopened after it was bought by the New York-based firm Patriarch Partners, headed by Lynn Tilton. To a lot of people here, including LeClaire, Tilton is an economic savior. But for the unionized floor workers, compromise was part of the deal.
We had to do concessions on vacations. We used to have a premium day on Sunday. We had to give that up. She's not the fairy godmother. She just does not show up with her checkbook, write you out a check and say, continue doing what you were doing.
For his part, though, LeClaire wants to keep doing what he's doing for at least 5 more years.
Then I'll be looking at retirement. And hopefully, at that time, Social Security will still be around.
And the North Country hopes the Gorham Paper Mill will still be around as well. For State Impact New Hampshire, I'm Amanda Loader.
Sandy's high winds transformed Elm Street into a wind tunnel. Signs along the street twisted and shuddered, and traffic light poles groaned under the powerful gusts of wind. Most businesses along the strip had closed for the evening, but a few lit up open signs could still be found. Neer Spindler, the owner of Cesario's Pizza, had a cavalier attitude towards the storm.
If I deliver in blizzards, then I can deliver in the hurricane.
Just a few units down at the gyro spot, manager Alex Lambrula said he didn't think the storm was as severe as it was made out to be.
Judging by customers coming in and just what they've been telling me, it hasn't been as crazy as they thought it was going to be.
Both Spindler and Lambrula say that as long as they have power, they'll stay open. For NHPR News, I'm Jonathan Lynch in Manchester.
The single-engine aircraft was traveling southbound along I-93 North when it struck a light pole and crashed along the roadway, coming to rest along a guardrail. There are 2 confirmed fatalities, a man and a woman. The man was ejected from the craft and is lying in the woods by the side of the highway. Traffic is moving slowly. It's been diverted to one lane and is traveling around the site of the accident. For NHPR News, I'm Sam Evans-Brown in Hooksett, New Hampshire.
More details are emerging today about the former Exeter Hospital employee who has been charged in connection with the hepatitis C outbreak there. 30 patients have tested positive for a strain of the virus that matches that of 32-year-old David Kwiatkowski. He's been accused of stealing syringes of pain medication, injecting himself, and then returning the needles. And he faces federal charges of tampering and acquiring a controlled substance by fraud. NHPR's Todd Bookman has been following the situation, and he joins me now. Todd, welcome.
Good afternoon, Brady.
We've learned this is not the first time David Kwiatkowski has been accused of drug diversion. Is that right?
That's right. Correct. There was an incident in 2008 at an undisclosed hospital. Employees there observed Kwiatkowski removing a syringe from an operating room. Management confronted him. They found three syringes of the drug fentanyl on his person. There was more paraphernalia found in his locker. It's not clear at this time if law enforcement was contacted about that episode, though.
David Kwiatkowski came to Exeter originally as a temporary employee in April of 2011. He's what's known in the field as a traveler. What exactly does that mean?
So this is apparently common for healthcare settings to take on temporary staff for their lower-level medical technology positions. These appointments can last for a few months. Often housing is provided by the staffing agency. Exeter says that when Kwiatkowski did arrive, he was drug tested and given a full background check. They did hire him for a full-time position in October 2011.
Authorities say several employees at Exeter Hospital had expressed concerns about his behavior. What did they see?
So several employees have told investigators that they'd seen Kwiatkowski with bloodshot eyes, at times sweating profusely through his hospital scrubs. There was an incident in 2011 in which a syringe of fentanyl was found in a public bathroom outside of the cath lab. The director of the cath lab interviewed Kwiatkowski about his bloodshot eyes on at least one occasion, and Kwiatkowski told him that he'd been up crying the night before, apparently, about a death in the family. He became inconsolable and was sent home for the day.
And it sounds like that wasn't necessarily the case.
Right. Investigators talked with Kwiatkowski's family, and they said there was no dead relative around that time. The 21-page affidavit filed in federal court paints a picture of an almost compulsive storyteller. Kwiatkowski has claimed to have had cancer at times. There's no record of that. He's lied about playing baseball for the University of Michigan. He claims that his fiance died. He's also denied that he knew of his Hep C status until May of this year when the outbreak became public. Authorities say he first tested positive, though, in June of 2010, well before arriving in New Hampshire. Sure.
U.S. Attorney John Kakavas told us yesterday this is the beginning of their investigation, not the end. So what comes next?
So Kwiatkowski remains hospitalized in Massachusetts. He's being treated for some undisclosed medical condition. He's had several run-ins with law enforcement since being fired from Exeter in May of this year. And you're right, U.S. Attorney John Kakavas says that he expects Kwiatkowski will be released next week, at which time he'll be transferred to custody here in New Hampshire. And public health officials and the CDC are now gathering information about the other hospitals that Kwiatkowski worked in before coming to Exeter. And Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore released a statement today saying that Kwiatkowski worked in their facility in 2009 and that he worked in at least three other Maryland hospitals.
Todd, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Brady.
And HPR's Todd Bookman. You can find our ongoing coverage of the hepatitis C outbreak at Exeter Hospital by going to our website, nhpr.org.
Mitt Romney spent his morning focusing on vote-rich southern New Hampshire. He started at a Chamber of Commerce breakfast in Nashua, where a comment he made about choice in health care,
"I like being able to fire people who provide services to me,"
became a late-breaking flashpoint. Democrats and Republican rivals Newt Gingrich, Rick Perry, and John Huntsman all piled on, so much so that at Romney's next stop in Hudson, he called a press conference, his first since the Iowa caucuses, to diffuse the matter.
I know free enterprise is on trial, and we have a president who really doesn't believe in the rights of people to do that, but I believe in the right of people to get rid of an insurance company they don't want.
Romney also clarified another comment that's become an unwelcome headache as he looks to mobilize the vote he's been working years to build, that he himself has feared being fired.
I think people imagine that I came in at the top of Bain & Company, the consulting firm, or the Boston Consulting Group. I started at the bottom. And like anybody that starts at the bottom of an enterprise, you wonder, when you don't do so well, whether you're going to be able to hang on to your job. You know, will you be one of those that's laid off?
The question now is, will Mitt Romney hang on to what every poll suggests remains a commanding lead in the state where he's never been anything but the clear frontrunner? Speaking at a high school gymnasium in Windham, Mr. Obama told a crowd of 2,300 that the policies of Romney and Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan would benefit the rich and hurt the middle class. Mr. Obama argued that under the budget supported by Ryan, Romney would pay less than 1% of his income in taxes. The president also said Romney's plans would raise taxes on middle-class families by $2,000 a year.
They have been trying to sell this trickle-down snake oil before. It did not work then. It will not work now. It's not a plan to create jobs. It will not reduce the deficit. It will not move the economy forward. It's the wrong direction for America.
The president carried New Hampshire in 2008. Recent polls here show Mr. Obama and Mitt Romney running neck and neck. Romney and Ryan are slated to campaign in Manchester on Monday. For NPR News, I'm Josh Rogers in Concord, New Hampshire.
Can I introduce you to Maggie Hassan? This is Robert Field, attorney here in town.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Maggie Hassan is working the room. She's shaking hands with members of the Seacoast's financial industry at the largest Rotary Club in New England. She's 54 and running for governor on a platform of investment in education and job training and healthcare expansion. Before she begins yet another stump speech, the Rotarians recite the Pledge of Allegiance, then sing together. She's not a bad singer, Maggie Hassan. She says she sang in church and school choirs from childhood through her college years at Brown University. Hassan grew up in Lincoln, Massachusetts, a well-to-do suburb of Boston. Her father was a professor at MIT. Later, he worked as the Undersecretary for Housing and Urban Development under Lyndon B. Johnson. Sue Krabiel went to Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School with Hassan. When Krabiel's parents moved to Minnesota during her senior year, she moved in with the Hassan family.
They had a wonderful old New England house in Lincoln at the top of the hill that had this old grass tennis court in the back.
Dinner time at the Hassan family, Krabiel says, was kind of intimidating. She says they were super smart and really political.
I mean, there were signed pictures from JFK in the study and things like that. And we'd sit at this dinner table and have conversations about, like, current events and major right and wrong in the world kind of issues.
Hassan says her first political memory was collating mailers for the League of Women Voters as a young girl. And Hassan says she was shaped by conversations with her parents at mealtime.
My parents always wanted to hear from everybody.
All three siblings would bring friends over, not to mention her father's colleagues and mother's friends.
And so it just wasn't unusual for us to have a whole lot of voices at the table.
For the last 24 years, Maggie Hassan has lived in houses owned by Phillips Exeter Academy, where her husband is the principal. The house they live in now looks grand from the outside. Inside, it's decorated pretty modestly.
Let me introduce you around. This is my husband, Tom.
Hi, Meg. Nice to meet you.
This is Liz Halliday.
Hi, nice to meet you.
My might-as-well-be daughter lives here and helps with Ben and...
Hassan's family is gathered around the kitchen eating leftovers. There's a funny-shaped island in the middle of the room.
The counter was designed so that Ben's wheelchair can pull up at this level so we can all sit around here with Ben.
Hassan's son Ben is listening to the radio in a bedroom next to the kitchen. He's 24 and has cerebral palsy.
Oh, but Ben, it's Call Me Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, wait, it's Call Me Maybe. A cultural reference that, Ben, I actually do know. Just saying. And I just wanted you to meet Ben, and he's actually using his hand right now to say hello. He can understand everything but can't speak.
A lot of voters in New Hampshire know Ben's story because Hassan talks about him frequently on the campaign trail.
The thing I want to talk to you about today blends a little bit of my experience as a state senator with my much more important experience as a mom.
In the 90s, Hassan, then a corporate attorney for Brigham and Women's Hospital, began advocating for disabled people and their families.
When Congressman Frank Ginta goes out knocking on the doors of Independence in Manchester, his political backyard, most everybody knows who he is.
Good morning.
Hey, Congressman Ginta. Hey.
How are you Sorry doing?
Hey, Gacy, you want to meet a congressman? This is Congressman Ginta. Hey, all right. How are you doing?
But that doesn't necessarily mean that every door that opens has a smiling supporter on the other side, which is the case with Gus Emick.
Unfortunately, I have to say this. I'm voting for your opponent because, not it's not as much about you as personally as about the Republican Congress in general. So
Emick's frustration with the gridlock in Congress is what Democrats are banking on this election season, and Carol Shea Porter's campaign is no exception. The tactic so far has been to call him extreme and obstructionist, mostly by linking him to the Tea Party.
Tea Party Congressman Frank Ginta voted for billions in cuts to veterans programs.
As a voice for the Tea Party, Congressman Frank Ginta voted to gut the program that's helped our families for almost 50 years.
But even as the Shea Porter campaign tries to tie him to the House of Representatives in voters' minds, the Ginta campaign may be trying to obscure what has traditionally been an advantage, incumbency.
Frank Ginta, candidate for Congress, running against Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. I'm running to end the broken culture of Washington, improve our economy, and get grandstanders back to work.
That was a robocall that the Ginta campaign ran in August and again just a few weeks ago. There's nothing inaccurate about Ginta calling himself candidate Frank Ginta and his opponent, Congresswoman Shea Porter. But an uninformed voter listening to that call might think that Ginta was the challenger and not the other way around. UNH professor Dante Scala says that's the point.
You know, if a congressman could get away with running against Congress, this would certainly be the year to try and do that, given how very unpopular Congress is these days.
Not that this is a new technique. Scala notes in 2008, when Shea Porter was an incumbent running against Jeb Bradley, who she had unseated 2 years before, a mailer from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee walked the same fine line.
That mail, if you looked at it, and that alone, you would have thought Jeb Bradley was the incumbent in the district.
The first congressional district covers most of the eastern half of the state. It stretches from the seacoast to Jackson and North Conway and includes cities like Manchester, Portsmouth, Laconia, and Rochester.
You can't really say that Mormonism was born in New England, but its founder and prophet, Joseph Smith, was. Back in 1805, Smith was born in a small house in rural South Royalton, Vermont. Today, his Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints runs a 400-acre memorial site. Speakers in the woods pipe music from the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. A 38-and-a-half-foot-tall stone obelisk dominates the area. Each foot represents a year of Smith's life.
Last year, we had 35,000 people come here to visit this site. And of those 35,000, about half of them were members of the church.
Retiree Elder Brian Shuck is doing his third stint as a Mormon missionary. Inside the visitor center, he shows off a framed print depicting a 7-year-old Smith after the family had moved to Lebanon, New Hampshire. He had contracted typhoid fever, which eventually settled into a bone in his leg.
We have here a portrait of Joseph's surgery. It was an experimental procedure performed by the founder of Dartmouth Medical School.
When the family left New England for Western New York in 1816, Smith was still on crutches. But despite these historical connections, Mormonism has never really taken deep root in the area. The Association of Statisticians of American Religious Bodies did a census in 2010. The group found only about 8,200 Mormons in New Hampshire. The state ranks 46th in the country for Mormon population. While the census found 21 Latter-day Saints congregations in New Hampshire, this small meeting house in Wolfboro has become the most famous. This is where the Romneys worship when they visit their summer home on Lake Winnipesaukee. But this time of year, the region's off-season, there are fewer than 50 regulars. One of them is 76-year-old Della Cody Jordan. She converted from Protestantism in 1962.
Well, my neighbors, we all went to church in Alton. They had joined the church, and so I says, what is it about this Mormon religion that you all joined? And they said, well, come find out for yourself. So I did. So we met in a factory in Winnesquam at that time. And just the first time I got there, is like everything that they said made sense.
Today, the congregation has a proper church building. And, in efficient Mormon fashion, it's designed so that it can be easily expanded to fit a growing congregation. There aren't a lot of homegrown Mormons here. Most of the members are converts. New convert Jason Charles Jedry says it hasn't always been easy.
It definitely has its challenges. There's always going to be opposition wherever you go.
Jedry says his Catholic relatives are okay with his conversion. But it can sometimes be tough fitting back into New England culture.
Oh, I've had people come up to me and ask if I wanted to go out for a drink after work. And I tell them that I don't drink. It's against my religion. And they're like, against your religion? It's like, what do you mean? You can't have one beer? It's like, not that we can't have one beer. It's that we don't want to have one beer. It is against our religion to have any strong drink, alcohol, coffee, or tea.
Those Mormon beliefs have become better known thanks to a number of things. Take Mitt Romney's candidacy, the success of the Twilight books and movies, and the satirical Book of Mormon Broadway musical. The media calls this change the Mormon moment. But in some ways, this is a tricky time to be Mormon. The church is firm in its declaration that when it comes to politics, it's neutral. There have been a number of prominent Mormon Republicans, like Mitt Romney, but Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is also a member of the church, And here in New Hampshire, former Congressman Dick Sweat and his wife Katrina are prominent Democrats. While the institutional church acknowledges this diversity among individual Mormons or Latter-day Saints, it's very protective of its neutrality and its members. I was allowed to interview New Hampshire Mormons only on the condition that I not ask political questions.
Every political season, the president of the church comes out with a letter reminding people that we're
lead. It's still early, but it's a lead. Well, I think, Laura, that folks are probably thinking this is a bit premature to call anything yet. There are certainly a couple of typically Republican towns that have been called early for Carol Shea Porter, Seabrook and Belmont, for example, which both in 2008 and 2010 went to Shea Porter, have been called, or went to Ginta, have been called for Shea Porter this time around. So, you know, it's too soon to say anything. With 2% reporting, really the numbers aren't indicative of much. So, you know, folks are relatively relaxed. People are having dinner, chatting. The room is pretty quiet still. You know, we've probably got about a dozen or 18 people in here. So certainly it's not a mob scene. And I know that there's been a lot of talk of how slow the polls have been in Manchester, how long the lines were, how long it's going to be before we start getting results from there. So really, people are just sort of biding their time. There's no real excitement or disappointment yet.
And looking at the state of New Hampshire or this district,
graduations are occasions to celebrate. Last night's was no different. Friends and family of New Hampshire's newest law enforcement agents filled the room to see the 157th Police Academy class receive their certificates. But the mood in Concord was bittersweet as Governor John Lynch addressed the crowd.
We're here tonight with sadness in our hearts, saddened by the death of Greenland Police Chief Michael Maloney and the shooting of four other officers.
Maloney was just a week away from retirement when he was killed by a gunshot to the head during a drug raid Thursday night. The suspected gunman and another person were also killed. Attorney General Michael Delaney addressed the graduating class of 37 officers. He told them to be proud of their chosen career.
As we remember the memory of Police Chief Michael Maloney, you should know that you are joining much more than a noble profession. You are joining a brotherhood and a sisterhood that will always be there for you, no matter what the issue at hand.
After the ceremony, moms and dads, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives posed for pictures with the cadets. Deborah LaRusso was here to see her son Sabato become the newest member of the Newton Police Department. She said the shooting is very much on her mind.
When I heard about what happened to the other police officers yesterday, I did sit down and have that moment of, wow, you know, but I know this is what he wants, but that feeling, that how the families must feel, and, you know, because he can be here today and gone tomorrow. You know, I just don't know.
After 14 weeks in the academy, Jason Reinhold, a tall man wearing the starched uniform of the Nashua Police Department, is ready to join the force. He sees the events in Greenland as a sobering final lesson for his graduating class, one not likely to be forgotten.
It definitely brings home the point that the job is dangerous. It's something you have to take serious all the time. You can't take anything for granted. Anything can happen at any moment, and it can happen really fast.
The investigation into the Greenland shootings is ongoing. Two of the officers shot in the incident remain at Portsmouth Hospital. Autopsy results of the suspected shooter and the unidentified woman that was found dead with him are expected to be released later today. For NHPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.
The town of Sugar Hill, population 500 or so, is aptly named. Near the summit of the hill that it's mostly on is the driftwood cottage of Polly's Pancake Parlor. When the wind is right, the fragrance of syrup and butter that pours across the road stops your car as surely as a sheep drive. Possesses possibly the best views of any pancake house in the Western world, a famous travel guide reports. As you continue over Sugar Hill and down into the huddle of trees and sudden white steeples, you'll soon find yourself near Harmon's Cheese and General Store. Across the street from Harmon's is the town hall that used to be a school, next to the museum that used to be a firehouse. Right next to Harmon's is the small white hut of the post office that used to be a blacksmith shop. And on Saturday, a small sign was taped to the post office door. Town selectman Dick Billifield stands outside the door and reads the note.
All right, effective Saturday, May 26, 2012, the rural carrier will service this facility from 10:15 to 10:45 each day. Customers will be able to purchase stamps only. No other retail services will be provided. We appreciate your cooperation. Yeah.
Sugar Hill's post office is now open only 30 minutes a day. It may be a new world record on the dubious side of decreasing values. The most remote post office in the country, Anaktuvik Pass in Alaska, services a town of 300 and is open from 9 to 5.
If they could make it any more inconvenient, I don't know how they could. Sugar Hill is a largely retired people. And this is a communication center for town. And to have it open 30 minutes a day is borders on organized insanity. And the way they did it totally rubs us wrong.
Brenda Aldrich runs the cheese shop next door.
We're in shock. We had no warning. We're numb. You know, to come, a lot of people were gone for the three-day weekend. So to come back Tuesday and see a sign on the door that says you've lost all your services other than buying stamps, this was a full-service post office.
Last year, Brenda's shop did $11,000 worth of business at this post office. In only one day, business has shifted.
On the first day, Tuesday, I should have sent 9 packages out, and I only sent 5, and I sent the other 4 by UPS. The 4 I shipped were the flat rate, which is $11 something each, so there's $44 they lost the first day.
Brenda's not the only one keenly aware of the post office's bottom line.
My advice is, when Brenda called, talk to Charlie Bass.
During the school year, a quarter of New Hampshire students qualify for free and reduced lunch. During the summer, the number of kids getting those federally subsidized healthy lunches drops to less than 2%, according to the Food Resource Action Center. 14-year-old Daniel Coulter is one student who loses access to those lunches.
Yeah, I ate a lot of food. Even though I don't look it, but I ate a lot of food.
And his mom, Crystal Coulter, says her pocketbook feels it.
You know, through the year in the school, we're so used to not feeding them lunch, it kind of hurts the budget when school gets out.
But the Coulters are getting a little help this summer from a Laconia program called Got Lunch.
Good morning, folks. Welcome to week 5.
Every Monday during the summer, a couple dozen volunteers gather in the basement of the Congregational Church in Laconia. They take cans of tuna, bunches of bananas, and enough lunch supplies for 5 meals for each family they serve and sort them into reusable grocery bags.
We have 72 and we need 117.
Some of the food is donated, while the rest is purchased at a food bank with donated money. Volunteers deliver bags of groceries to nearly 450 Laconia children and their families.
Are you ready? Yeah!
When kids lose access to free and reduced lunch, the worry is that they'll go hungry. But paradoxically, it isn't the only worry.
Interestingly, that's led to a bigger obesity problem because kids losing the structure of those school meals and left on their own and unsupervised are making some poor health choices in what they are feeding themselves.
The director of the National Summer Learning Association, Gary Huggins, says studies show kids who lose their free and reduced lunch during the summer are more likely to gain weight rapidly.
My name is Emma Gildesgame.
My name is Eric Gotthold.
Seth Bishop.
Emily Lake.
Sarah Fisher.
My name is Nick Anderson, and I'm part of the
Greenleaf Crew.
C-R-O-O.
C-R-O-O. So they began construction of Greenleaf Hut in 1929. They finished by the summer season of 1930. The way they did it was they used mules and pack boards.
Yeah, so a pack board is essentially a wooden frame. It looks kind of like a ladder. It has hooks, and so we strap boxes and garbage bags and all sorts of pretty much anything can be strapped to a pack board.
I have 2 turkeys and some grapefruits.
We strap loads. Generally, the loads are between 150 to 250 pounds, spread out over 4 or 5 of us.
Sometimes I love packing, but it's a pretty serious love-hate relationship going on.
Weather up here is not small talk. It is big news.
At 3,300 feet, 53.6 degrees.
Things can blow in pretty quick, and the clouds can be really intense and roll up and funnel through the ridge and all the notch, and everything gets really loud.
Working up here in the huts, people get very close, and sometimes romantic relationships do come out of this job. I am dating the Madison Spring hut master, and so she's over on the other end of the hut system. If we wanted to see each other, we'd each have to hike 20 miles. She'd be heading west and I'd be heading east. It's definitely very easy to fall in love with people up here.
What's your least favorite part?
Probably stirring Clivus, which is the composting toilet system that we have here at the huts.
Oh, I don't mind that. You know, this job has a lot of perks, so it's good to have a task that really grounds you a bit.
Oh my God, how am I gonna cook for 30 people, 40 people, 90 people?
I really, 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 really enjoy cooking.
We make food that we wanna eat because we eat it as well.
We're gonna start off the evening with a tomato vegetable soup, accompanied by honey oatmeal bread, and followed by a subalpine zone garden salad. And the main course tonight is a pork loin with homemade applesauce and bow tie pasta on the side. And that is going to be followed by a very, very special surprise dessert. So you have a lot to look forward to coming right up.
Doing dishes for 40 people is the best. All you really do is wash dishes really quickly.
Keep moving. Yeah, that's the motto of diving dishes up here in the huts.
It's a lot of fun.
It's 5:45 a.m. and I'm making some sourdough pancakes for breakfast. It's very early.
I do this job not simply for the place, but for the people. Every summer I meet better people and new people, and they keep me coming back. It just happens to be so that this is on the side of a mountain in northern New Hampshire.
Hi, welcome to Hobbycraft.
Hi.
Wow. Grevier Furniture Anything has been special? A fixture in downtown Franklin for decades. But last summer, the family carved out another space in its large red brick complex for a new type of shop. It's all New Hampshire-made handicrafts. The store is filled with the kinds of old New England items you'd expect. Shaker boxes and rocking chairs, painted wooden loons, model ships, jewelry, and baskets. Andrea Grevier, who owns the store with her husband, shows off her wares to a customer.
Now that's a nightlight, and behind there are other panels.
Oh, that's cool. What a great idea.
What makes the store different from your standard New Hampshire craft shop is the craftsmen themselves. They're inmates at the Men's State Prison in Concord. The Department of Corrections used to run its own gift shop, where inmates in the Hobbycraft program could sell their wares. But by 2011, budget cuts forced the prison to cut staffing down to just a few hours, one day a week.
So we were tasked by one of our supervisors to think outside the box and try to come up with some other ideas.
John Limoges supervises the Hobbycraft shop. The state put out a proposal asking for businesses to bid on the opportunity to stock their shelves with prison-made goods. Grevier Furniture won.
The cost of the state to send stuff up there is nothing. We don't transport it. It's 100% on the furniture store now. They come down here, they pick it up, they bring it up there, they sell it.
Under the contract, Grevier's gets 20% of the price of each item sold. 10% goes into the Department of Corrections Recreation Trust Fund to keep programs like the Hobbycraft Shop open. Because it isn't an official prison job, the inmates get to keep the rest. But the state doesn't pay for their materials or tools, so prisoners use a lot of the money to buy more supplies. Prisoners in the wood shop work with saws, hammers, and chisels. But over on the other side of the sprawling shop, men sit in a smaller, quieter room, making baskets and painting. Tim Barry paints a scene from an idyllic Vermont village, complete with horse-drawn sleigh. He's 26 years into his sentence for second-degree murder. At 63 years old now, he's not far away from his parole hearing. He taught himself to paint in prison.
When I'm here with this painting, with any painting, I'm someplace other than prison. And one of his essays, Schopenhauer wrote, "To an artist, it doesn't matter if the sunrise is seen from a prison or from a palace." I understand what he meant now.
Barry works mostly from memory and pictures clipped from newspapers and magazines. Talking about himself and his art, his words are steeped in metaphor. He grabs a smaller canvas, showing a rusted-out 1955 Red Mack truck.
Maybe this is a self-portrait. That's a truck that can't run. And I'm in here. I miss the trucks. I drove long haul. When a truck is moving cross country, that's freedom. It's a sense of freedom. It's the opposite of being in prison. You're always moving. The scene's always changing. But when I do my art, the scene's always changing.
Barry's work is displayed on the walls at Grevier's. He says some of his pieces have already sold for $125 to $250 with the frame.
It feels good to be in prison and not have to have my family support me. And this time of the year, if I want to buy them presents, I got the money to do that.
Just a few feet over, 49-year-old Mark Van Zandt sits at a table, weaving baskets. He's been in the men's prison for 15 years, also serving a sentence for second-degree murder. For about half that time, Van Zandt has been making baskets in the hobbycraft shop. Like most inmates, he doesn't factor the cost of labor into his work. He just doubles the cost of the materials. He holds up his latest creation.
This is a market basket. It can be used for, you know, decoration, or it can be used for actually, you know, out in the field if you were, you know, picking up vegetables and other such things.
He figures he'll put $45 on this basket, which is bound for Grevier's. So far, all but two of his baskets have sold, and they need more stock. Van Zandt says it's about more than the money, though.
Actually, it's pretty, it's rewarding. It's nice to know that, you know, that you can make something that other people will be interested in, and, you know, they appreciate your art, you know.
Back at the Franklin store, Andrea Grevier says she's thrilled with her unusual arrangement with the state.
And I've gotten so much from this by the gratitude of each and every person involved. And the public has well received it. And not that these gentlemen did not do some things they shouldn't have, but they're still people. And I've seen a different side to the prison system.
The store's contract runs through 2014. Then the state will have the option to renew for another 2 years. For NHPR News, I'm Amanda Loader.
Jeffrey, we're glad you're here.
Can I say more nice things about David Souter so I can keep getting applause at all times?
Yes, that's what we're going to do the entire interview tonight about. Tell us again about David Souter's niceness. Well, thank you so much for being here. I want to get to the main topic of the oath. Two personalities, President Barack Obama, Chief Justice John Roberts. You talked about in the book about a lot of their similarities. They both went to Harvard. They both made the Harvard Law Review. Brilliant students, charming, great writers. But the distinctive difference in their vision about the Constitution. Talk to us about that.
You know, Roberts, as I mentioned earlier, is someone who really came of age as part of the Reagan Revolution. And the Reagan Revolution, as far as the Supreme Court was concerned, is a real revolution in the sense that he wants to see change. You know, abortion, civil rights, campaign finance, church state. I mean, there is a procession of cases that Roberts would like to see undone, and he is making good, if imperfect, progress across the board because of the fact that there are five Republicans and four justices. Obama, in contrast, is someone who cares not that much about the courts. It's very striking to me. I mean, here's a guy who was president of the Harvard Law Review, who was obviously very knowledgeable about the court. But as he wrote in his book, The Audacity of Hope, he thinks that liberals have relied too much on the courts. He's someone who believes change comes from politics and elections. And he is not someone who really has put a lot of emphasis on appointing judges. Now, he is certainly proud of his two appointments to the Supreme Court, but he has not even filled all the seats that he could on the lower federal courts. And he is very much a status quo type person. And the paradox at the beginning of the oath is that Roberts is the candidate of change and Obama is the candidate of the status quo.
Yeah, tell us about that. Well, I'd love to hear that, this description of what is it like in there, these still, silent marble halls is the way we think of it. But you point out that, you know, the Chief Justice assigns them to the cafeteria committee, the decoration committee.
Yeah,
it's like being at the office.
The Supreme Court as an institution works somewhat like a university faculty in that except for
the opinions, the substantive work. The Chief Justice sort of runs it like the dean, and there are a lot of committees. There's the building committee, and the justices are very...
I'm Rick Ganley with New Hampshire Public Radio News. Federal prosecutors say it could take a year or more before a trial in the hepatitis C outbreak case begins. On Wednesday, a grand jury indicted 33-year-old David Kwiatkowski on 14 charges, including tampering with a consumer product. The former Exeter Hospital employee is accused of stealing syringes of a powerful pain medication, injecting himself, and then reusing the needles on patients. U.S. Attorney John Kakavas says the FBI and members of law enforcement continue to investigate the case.
This indictment by the grand jury really just signals another step in the process. It's a long way from over. We still have work to do.
An attorney for Kwiatkowski could not be reached for comment. The suspect denies the charges and claims he was unaware of his hepatitis C status. The state-owned Cannon Mountain Ski Area opens today for its 75th season. It's part of the annual reawakening of the ski business, a crucial part of the state's economy. NHPR's Chris Jensen has this report.
The snowmaking machines have been going all out at Cannon Mountain for several weeks, says marketing director Greg Keeler.
On Friday for opening day, we're planning on having three trails, that's roughly two routes down, and two lifts open as well.
He says the base is between 12 and 18 inches on those slopes, which are aimed at intermediate and advanced skiers. As with other resorts, only part of the mountain is available. Cannon will be opening three of its 73 trails.
Well, yeah, this time of year you go one or two at a time and do the best you can. The stuff we're going to have open is fairly wide, so it's a significant amount of area to cover. So it'd be three trails out of 73.
Other resorts opening Friday are Gunstock, Cranmore, and Mount Sunapee. Saturday, Pat's Peak and Ragged Mountain are scheduled to open. Resorts that are already open include Bretton Woods, Wildcat, Loon, and Waterville Valley. The ski industry plays a huge part in the state's economy. Skiers spend about $300 million a year, according to Plymouth State University. For NHPR News, this is Chris Jensen.
Vice President Joe Biden led yesterday's tribute on Capitol Hill to late New Hampshire Senator Warren Rudman, recalling him as forthright, frugal, and fair. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, Arizona Senator John McCain, and former Supreme Court Justice David Souter, a close friend, were among many friends and former colleagues at Thursday's memorial event. Rudman died November 19th at age 82. He co-authored a groundbreaking budget balancing law, championed ethics, and led a commission that predicted the danger of homeland terrorist attacks before the attacks in 2001. The feisty former New Hampshire Attorney General went to the Senate in 1981 with a reputation as a tough prosecutor. He was called on by Senate leaders and later by presidents of both parties. We'll have a cold day in the Granite State, but the weather will moderate later in the weekend. Meteorologist Rob Carolyn has more with the forecast.
Sunshine will be developing from north to south across the state today, but it looks to be relatively cold. Highs across the North Country today, 20 to 25, around 30 in central New Hampshire, and southern New Hampshire will be 30 to 35 this afternoon. Clouding up tonight, a few snow showers possible, especially across western parts of the state. Lows 5 to 10 above in the North Country tonight, around 15 in central New Hampshire and 15 to 20 in the southern part of the state. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, a few rain or snow showers around. Rain showers are likely in southern New Hampshire tomorrow afternoon, snow showers the rest of the state. Western and northern areas could see 1 to 2 inches of snowfall tomorrow, highs 30 to 40. Lots of clouds and milder Sunday, 45 in the north, 55 in the south. For NHPR, I'm meteorologist Rob Carolyn.
And this is NHPR News.